Hey everyone, it's Brett here. Quick note just to begin. Some of you have been listening to the podcast for a while, and I realize you may not know what we do at Art of Coaching. The podcast is just one small extension. We are focused on leadership development, and really we sit at the crux of all things leadership, entrepreneurship, and relationships. So if you're somebody that wants to improve how you communicate so that your business can run more smoothly, or maybe it makes your marketing better, or you want to do it because you want to be able to better relate to your spouse or your kids, we have something for you. If you're somebody that wants to improve your staff development, and maybe they need to work on conflict resolution, negotiation, problem solving under pressure, we have programs for that. We do things that are live and virtual so that you can have access to the content you need when it matters most. Please check us out. Go to artofcoaching.com. We've helped people in more than 30 different professions solve some of their biggest problems, because all things human and social are where those problems reside. Learn how to be more confident when you speak. Learn how to get your point across more clearly. Learn how to navigate the power dynamics inherent to life and work. Again, that's artofcoaching.com. And if you have specific questions, you can email us at info@artofcoaching.com. For our live events, we have group discounts, student discounts, first responder discounts. We do in-services all over the world, and we have a dedicated team that can help you no matter what your problem is. We'd be honored to serve you. Last time, that's artofcoaching.com. This episode of the Art of Coaching podcast is brought to you by Momentus. Simple phrase here, control the controllables. Whenever life seems like it's moving faster and faster, the best thing you can do is nail down the fundamentals. That's it. And one of those fundamentals is just making sure you're aware of what you put in your body. One of the things that I always use for Momentus, well, I'll give you two actually, is their fish oil and their creatine. Simple reasons here. We all know that fish oil, quality fish oil, helps with blood profiles, manage inflammation, and the like. And creatine helps with strength, power, and overall performance. And that doesn't matter if you have a desk job. When you strength train, you want to give your body what it needs to perform in the way that you'd like it to. And the fish oil and the creatine from them are just two examples. They have products that can help you sleep. They have products that will help you with hydration. Whatever you need, they have it. And best yet, it's NSF certified. For those of you that don't know, that means it goes through some of the most rigorous testing there is. Most supplements are not tested. You don't even know what's being put in your body. It's not regulated by the FDA. With Momentus, you know you are getting stuff that is certified, it's been tested, they know what's in it. So whether you go with the fish oil, the creatine, the grass-fed whey protein, anything like that, you can use the code BRETT15, that's BRETT15, for anything at livemomentus.com. It's all in the show notes to get a 15% discount. Check them out, you won't regret it.
Check it out, check it.
Welcome to the Art of Coaching podcast. I'm Brett Bartholomew, and at a young age, poor communication nearly cost me my life. Now, I help others navigate the gray area of social interaction, power dynamics, and communication so they can become more adaptable leaders regardless of their profession, age, or situation. This podcast is for everybody who is fascinated with solving people problems. So if you're the no-nonsense type who appreciates frank conversations, advice you can put to use immediately, and learning how others navigate the messy realities of leadership, you're in the right place. I'm glad that you're joining us. Let's dive in. Nice to have you with me for another episode. Today, we have Tyson Shumway joining us. Tyson spent 16 years as a member of the law enforcement community. He spent 7 years working as a part of SWAT, and he teaches defensive tactics and serves as a firearm instructor to boot. He's a husband and a father of four, and we touched on a lot of topics that can apply to every aspect of your life today, specifically how to de-escalate conflict, how to manage our emotions when we're in tense situations, how you should behave around police officers. Hopefully you don't find yourself in that circumstance much. But ultimately, because of the nature of his job being so high risk and such high stakes, we took a lot of things and extracted them. So whether you're teaching in a boardroom, a classroom, or anywhere in between, you can apply these tactics today. So turn your volume up, listen in, and here is Tyson Shumway. Welcome back to another episode of the Art of Coaching Podcast. I'm here with Tyson Shumway. Tyson, welcome, I'd say, like, to my house. You're sitting across from me.
I am. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It's very rare we get to do a live interview. I mean, usually I get Jack Nicholson out here occasionally, Matthew McConaughey, but today we got you, so it's a real treat.
Yeah, I'm glad to be sitting in the same seat that they've sat in.
Yeah, so, Jack Nicholson was actually right there. Awesome. And it was odd because when I was interviewing him, he wouldn't quit eating a steak. He came with a T-bone. But when Jack Nicholson starts doing things like that, you don't question it.
Yeah, I thought you were providing the steak today. Is that not?
That's what Liz is cooking right behind you. Awesome. Yeah, we got that. No, on a real note, I'm happy to have you here. You're going to be the second police officer we've had on the show. And given that we talk so much about communication strategy, perception, power dynamics, to me, it's just a natural fit. You and people in your position have to deal with so many unique circumstances. But because our audience isn't familiar with you, I'd love you to just, if you could ground your position, what you do, how long you've been a part of the force, and just give us some insight in terms of what a day in the life of your responsibilities is like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in law enforcement for about 16 years. I work for an agency in California, and I've worked in a lot of different capacities. Right now, I'm currently working the road as a patrol officer, but I've done 7 years of SWAT. I've also taught at our academy for a number of years. So I've worked with a lot of cadets, a lot of teaching, and a lot of instructing. And I also do that now in my own capacity now as a teach for firearms training, and I also teach officers in-service training and teach them how to be safe on the road and how to do their job.
So a good mix of, and you consolidated that really well, a good mix of teaching, a good mix of your day-to-day responsibilities. Have you always been an officer in the state of California? You've been elsewhere. How did that career continue to progress, or where did it start?
Yeah, so I started in California, and I've been an officer. I started down in South LA. I worked in the LA area, and then after about 2 years, I moved up to Sacramento, and I've been in that area ever since in the SWAT capacity or teaching at our academy, and now I currently patrol the streets in Sacramento. And then I also teach outside of the department as well. I teach for a company who teaches firearms training and tactics and things like that as well.
So given that, I was talking to Liz about this before you came on, and it's funny because the average person, right, they tend to run into law enforcement. They either see them passing by or they've gotten pulled over. And everybody knows what it's like the first time you get pulled over by a police officer. I mean, your heart is in your throat. But I don't think a lot of people consider what it's like from your end and so many of the things that you run into. Can you give us a little insight, whether that was your first stop or things that you've learned? I mean, there are so many things we could tap into here, but I think it's just important to give the perspective of what it's like from the other end of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you never know what you're going to run into. You know, every time you pull over a car, it's a different situation. So it's from pulling over cars down in Los Angeles and running into cars that maybe had tinted windows, or somebody that you walk up on the car, you're not sure if it's a grandma or if it's some dude that's there to try to hurt you. So running into those situations is always interesting. And that's what's exciting about the job. From that, not just pulling over cars, but actually going into houses is a part of our SWAT team, yeah. You know, kicking in a door and going into houses and not knowing what you're going to find, finding some crack dealer that you're going to arrest, and he has two hookers in the bedroom that you have to arrest as well that are wearing crotchless underwear and things like
and
that.
And there's so kids in the house, so you got to manage.
You never know what you're dealing with.
So with that, I mean, you have to perform a lot of calculations. I know just me teaching in front of groups, which is in no way comparable in terms of stakes. But even then, I'm thinking about, okay, how might I be coming across to this person? Because I can be very direct. I get very focused when I teach. How am I coming across to that person? Because I have to make sure that I manage. We talk a lot about it at Art of Coaching. As you know, you facilitate for us. We talk about impression management, and there's ranges of your authentic self. So talk to me a little bit more of that, building off of what we just said. Because there's sometimes, like, you kick in the door.
Yeah.
Okay, you know how you're coming across, and that's not really the main concern. You're kicking in a door for a reason. But when you approach a vehicle, right, like, you have to somehow manage your emotional state. So even though you might come across a certain way, right? Oh, now it's an older lady, or now it's a guy that looks really tough, but I can tell he's really scared and I don't want to elevate or potentiate his sense of threat. So how do you manage that range of who you really are while making sure that you also keep things calm and steady? Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I always, whenever I walk up in a car into those situations, I always try to take it from a bird's eye view. You know, I try to take a step back and realize that I just stopped them. I'm kind of on their playing field, but they're also on my playing field. I need to react to whatever they're going to do. So depending on what the situation is, I try to treat them with the amount of respect that they deserve, right? I try to treat the situation with respect and try to respect everybody that I'm talking to until they give me a reason to ramp it up.
Heads up, our only speaker school of the year is coming up on June 1st and June 2nd in Phoenix, Arizona. This is such a unique event. We keep it under 10 people. You get a chance to have a lot of reps and you get a lot of feedback in a judgment-free zone. We mix in a lot of fun. We'd go through everything on slide design, how to present more effectively, how to be more articulate. And it really doesn't matter whether you're trying to actually build a speaking career, continue to scale the one you have, or if you just want to get more confident speaking in front of crowds. We've had people that have came that have done TED Talks. We've had people that come that have social anxiety. It is a very welcoming atmosphere. So if you enjoy and appreciate the opportunity to grow and improve and connect with other like-minded people, and you want a chance to become more articulate, to become more fluent, to improve how you get your message across, do not miss Speaker School. Also, it is a perfect time of year to come to Phoenix. It is always right before it gets way too hot in the summer. You can make a little vacation out of it. You can go hiking. You can go to Sedona. You can go to Scottsdale. There's so much to do. So go to artofcoaching.com/speaker now. That's artofcoaching.com/speaker. Remember, this is our only one of the year. Early bird pricing is still available. We hope to see you there.
I try to treat them with the amount of respect that they deserve, right? I try to treat the situation with respect and try to respect everybody that I'm talking to until they give me a reason to ramp it up. You know, if they give me a reason to ramp it up, then I will ramp it up to where it needs to go. But for the most part, my interaction with the public is positive. So I'll walk up to the car, talk to them, tell them why I stopped them, and give them all the information that they need. I also always try to be personable with them. If they have something with their car that they need to fix or something that's an issue, then I just talk to them about that. And then we go on about our day. And 99% of my interactions are positive. We go away with positive. I don't write a lot of tickets. I'll walk up to them and I'll basically give them a verbal warning. Hey, you were going a little bit fast. You need to slow down. Because the way that I look at it is I'm there to surf and I'm there to make sure that the public is safe in any situation that they're in. So if I can make somebody go away from a situation with a smile on their face, rather than giving them a $500 ticket, that's what I try to do. But yeah, walking up and I think that's the kicker, right? Respecting everybody, giving them the respect that they deserve until they don't deserve your respect anymore.
Now, with that, and pardon, this is probably a dumb question. Do you guys get training on that? Like, do you go through simulations, role-playing scenarios, anything like that where you have to do this as part of your training?
We do, but not enough. So
what does that look like?
Yeah, basically walking up on a car and having a role player.
Fake, it's done at the station or somewhere else.
Yeah, we do it at the academy a lot. It happens a lot. And then once you graduate the academy, it doesn't happen as often. But every other year you have situations where you'll walk up on a car and that person could be anything from just a regular violator to somebody with a gun. So we do those simulations where you have to deal with different situations and be able to ramp it up, but also be able to de-escalate and bring it back down.
So do they give you, what is the learning material or your framework based upon, right? Because I would imagine that it's not just, hey, aimlessly practice with this other individual. What do you guys base your framework off something, whether it's negotiation, persuasion, a certain technique, anything like that? Or do they just kind of go over core principles like keep your calm, keep your cool, things like that?
Yeah, it's mostly just that. Just keep your calm, keep your cool, deal with the situation the way that it needs to be dealt with, ramp it up if you need to, but also be able to de-escalate. There's not a lot of instruction that goes into the communication process in police work. It's trial and error a lot of times.
So it's on you to learn those things on the back end yourself.
Yeah, which is why I research and try to study, and that's why I've been to a lot of the stuff that you teach and actually jumped into starting to teach with you guys, is because I think that that's so important in our field. We practice everything, right? We practice shooting. We practice rest and control. We do all those things, but we don't really practice the communication aspect. And I think that is one of the things that we can really incorporate a lot more, is being able to communicate with the public better and being able to deal with those situations that we might find ourselves in, so that we can de-escalate better and realize how people communicate and why they might communicate with us in a certain way, so that we can get a better, more positive outcome in the situations that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I mean, it's well said. It's one thing that you just think about it, even from a coaching standpoint or teaching, there's always consequences to the way that you coach, right? There's positive feedback loops, negative feedback loops, but it doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's consequences, and those consequences can happen in a multitude of formats. Well, the same thing with communication. And so I guess what I wonder here is, you think about all the PR, because police, I mean, you get your fair share of bad PR. And in some cases, and so I know some people won't like me hearing this, some cases maybe rightfully so, because there's assholes in every profession, right? But it's one of those things like the son pays for the sins of the father. So you have dirty cops, or you have some idiot cops that don't really take, they don't respect the public, or they maybe abuse their power. Now all of them look that bad.
Right.
So given that, I would just think the public perception, why do you think more time isn't paid on the communication side of things, or attention paid on the communication, given the perception, given the fact that you kind of do have to, you know, you're a walking billboard of what a police officer is about? Is it budget? Is it just perceived value?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think there's so many things that we have to train, and there's certain bureaucracies that put into place the things that we have to train. So we have a training matrix of, you have to do this, you have to go over hazmat, you have to go over arrest and control, the different things that we have to, that a lot of those things get put on the back burner. And in any given quarter, we get 1 8-hour training day. So 1 8-hour training day is
a quarter
is we get per quarter.
So four times a year.
Yeah. That's separate from like range. We get to go to range like once a month or
to practice shooting and everything
and stuff. But an actual training day where we practice arrest and control or anything like that is once per quarter. So it's really not enough. So that's why when I talk about to law enforcement, I love to train, I love to teach, and you've seen the stuff that I love to do outside of the job. That's why I put a lot of my own money and a lot of my own time into training, because this is more of a lifestyle than it is just a job. And a lot of those things are things that I feel like are necessary and could possibly one day save my life. Communicating with the public is what we do every single day.
That's the job.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's fascinating, because I have to ask, and there's so many other questions I want to ask about just law enforcement, but given that you bounce back and forth between doing that, your day job, and also teaching, what are some principles, other than paying attention to strategic communication, that have really crossed over? Or what are some things that you've just taken back from you that are just, hey, to teach effectively, also to interact effectively, anything that's crossed over in those domains? And what I mean, just to ground that, because I know it might not sound like the clearest question, is I can think back on my time working with athletes. It applies to everything we do now with Multitude Perfect. Like, I don't train athletes anymore. I haven't for a number of years. But dealing with personalities, conflict resolution, understanding egos, agendas, attitudes, how people learn, using constraints-based learning, right? So if I wanted an athlete to cut a certain way, I could put cones or an obstacle there so that would denote that. Same thing that you see we do in our workshops, right? We apply constraints so somebody has to do something. What are some principles that have really crossed over from you or made you more aware since you've been doing both?
I think one of the biggest things is just being able to listen. Listen to how they're communicating and realize that there's different ways to communicate. You know, we talk about it a lot. We have the different ways to communicate, as far as like being a realist, a relator, an analyst, or an empathizer. And I think in my job, whether I'm teaching or whether I'm working with the public, I have to be able to jump into each one of those communication styles, and I have to realize how that person is communicating back with me. And if they're more of an empathizer, I need to be able to empathize with them. If they're more of a relator, I need to be able to relate to them and do the things that I can to get on the same page as them. I think those are the biggest things that I've taken away, is being able to change my communication style when needed, but still be able to get my point across to the people that I'm trying to communicate with.
Do you find that hard, though? Because sometimes we'll run across people that will say, hey, you know, I've listened to the podcast, come to a course. I understand that there's different influence tactics, power dynamics, communication styles. For me, and I'm speaking as them, it gets really tough to be mindful of those things in the moment. And some of them are in, you know, corporate jobs. You have heightened stakes, and not to diminish what they do at all, right? But like, there are certain circumstances that are life and death for you. Have you ever struggled with that?
Like, oh yeah, 100%. And that's why I practice.
Right. That's,
you know,
training.
How many, yeah. And we do the scenario based training in my job, and I do scenario based training when I come to you. I think I've been to 3 or 4 different apprentices and helped facilitate a couple. And every single time I go, I learn more, and I try to take that back and practice the things like we talk about. We practice shooting. We practice all these things. Why don't we practice communication? So you don't ever see people role-playing a situation other than watching it on a video,
right.
Role-playing that type of situation where you're now trying to talk to somebody that was just in a domestic violence situation. We don't ever role-play that. We might watch a video and learn about how that happens or how what questions to ask, but we don't ever train that in a role-playing situation.
Yeah. We had somebody write in. They wanted me to ask you this question, and I know that this is a tough one. They say, hey, if I get pulled over, I feel like there's certain things you definitely don't want to do. I obviously know the obvious, like not reaching for a glove compartment or doing any drastic movements, even if I don't have anything. But I also feel like if I'm trying to be kind, I come off as disingenuous and could look suspicious. On the other hand, if I just act straight and narrow, bottom line is I don't know how to act in front of a police officer when they're in front of me. I feel intimidated. Does he have any principles of how I should behave so that I'm not perceived the wrong way?
Yeah, absolutely. It's different for a police, for each police officer,
right?
For me, when I walk up on your car, I'm gonna say, hey, how you doing? How's your day going? I'm just talking to a member of the public, you know, until the situation deems that I need to go to take it a step up. So if you're just a regular, average Joe citizen being pulled over, just keep your hands in view, and talk to me like, you know, like you saw me on the street, that I wasn't wearing my police uniform. I think that talking to us like normal people, for me personally, is a lot more respectful and gets so we can have a conversation rather than you being scared or having like I walk up to cars all the time and people's hands are shaking and they're upset. Like I don't take anything out of that as far as like suspicious.
Right.
They're just
because you know it's natural.
Yeah, they're just nervous. But just be relaxed and talk to me like I just stopped you on the street and we're having a conversation. Imagine that I'm not even wearing my police uniform. Hey.
You're naked. You're standing there naked.
Exactly. Yeah. Your registration's expired. I'm going to give you a correctable citation for it. Have a nice day. That's how most of my interactions go.
So with that, can you share a strategy or technique that you found in de-escalating tense situations? You alluded to some of them already, right? Managing your communication style, things like that, but just anything else that people could apply in everyday conflicts. And I'm thinking about, you know, some of our clients, we went out and did an in-service with an engineering firm. And some of the people there were very uncomfortable with conflict. And as you know, conflict takes many forms. It can be passive aggressiveness. It can be outright just anger, screaming, yelling. So I'm not asking you to cover the whole spectrum, but just what are some things that you've learned principle-wise about de-escalating a tense situation?
So first I'll determine what the situation is, right? I'll determine
context.
Yeah, context, and find out what's actually going on. And then a lot of times I'll just kind of just let them talk. I'm gonna sit there and listen and let them know that I'm listening, make that eye contact that I need to acknowledge that I'm listening to what they're saying, and then try to fix the problem. I might come up with some rational reasons as to how to de-escalate. I might empathize with them. There's, like I said before, the different types of communication that we need to have so that I can determine what I need to do in that situation. Every situation is different. But as far as just de-escalating, I think just giving them some space, taking a step back and letting them kind of vent a little bit is one of the biggest things. A lot of guys go in and try to fix the situation. They see someone that's ramped up or amped up and they think they need to go in and go hands-on immediately. I kind of just stand there quietly, you know, and not that I'm going to give them an inch, right? But if I need to jump in, I can. But I give them that time to kind of let them calm down on their own. You know, it's just like a toddler.
Right.
Right? I mean, you've all had seen temper tantrums from a toddler. If you kind of just let them sit there for a second, they realize, oh, like nobody cares that I'm yelling and screaming. And then we can actually have a conversation about what's going on.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you bring up because when you do think about it objectively, which is hard, it is hard to do, especially, and I don't, I've had to be more realistic about my own bias if I've studied this stuff a while now. And so you can forget how hard it is, even though it can be difficult for me too. But what I mean is you watch somebody, and to your point exactly, when somebody's having, when they're just losing it, or whether it is a tantrum or they're expressing themselves, that's right. Their way to remove stress. And a lot of times we feel compelled to have to respond to everything they do and say. And what I think I'm hearing you say is, hey, sometimes you just got to let them get that out. Don't respond to everything.
Right.
And then pick your moment.
And it's, yeah. And
is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's totally different per situation. Like if I walk up to onto a scene and a guy has a gun in his hand.
Sure.
Right. Then that's a totally different situation. You can only de-escalate so far.
So much, yeah.
Right. So I think that's a big thing too, is that the society wants us to de-escalate everything down to a positive encounter. And that's just not going to happen.
It's not going to be, you're not in control of all of that.
Right. Exactly. If they're escalated up to a deadly force situation, I might be able to de-escalate down to like a control hold.
That's a really good point.
Hands on.
Yeah.
But I can't de-escalate all the way down to like, okay, have a nice day and have a positive interaction out of that.
Well, I think that's really important for people to remember, because the average person doesn't have a camera on them all the time, or they don't have a body cam. And so when they see something on the news, right, it's very easy for them to react and, oh, did they have to do that? Did they have to do this? And it's, well, wait a minute. Think about if you had a camera on you every time you got in an argument with your spouse, or every time you lost it because something else happened. Like, you make a great point. There's levels of de-escalation.
Right.
You can maybe bring it down to a certain point. You're not going to be able to take every single interaction and make it what you want, because you're only one. We talk about complexity, right? At the apprenticeship. Complexity is, there's so many interdependent factors that are always engaging with one another. If somebody's on drugs, they're on meth,
yeah,
and there's a bunch of stuff going on around them, and then they see three officers, they're going to perceive you in a certain way, and you've got to react and adapt to that.
Absolutely.
And the best you can do is that's again why I was so surprised that there's not more training on de-escalation, because you revert back to your training in times of chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, that it would be great to be able to do that, especially with the more and more kind of mental health issues that we're seeing nowadays. Yeah. Being able to de-escalate that down, because it could be somebody that is just schizophrenic or is having a bad day, or you know, autism on the spectrum and stuff like that.
Yep.
We're seeing that more and more. So being able to realize that situation needs a different approach than somebody who is just committed a bank robbery.
Yeah.
And is trying to get away, right? Like, I'm going to treat them completely different.
Which, by the way, if you're new to the podcast or you've been listening for a while and you just want a reminder, we have a great episode we'll link in the show notes all about how to communicate with those who are neurodiverse. It's definitely worth checking out. There's nothing more complex in the universe than the human brain, and we are all wired and we all fire differently. And so it's really important to make sure to consider that. All right. So here's something I want to talk about as well is, you seem like a very calm, measured, pragmatic, experienced guy. But you screw up like the rest of us.
Absolutely.
What are some things that you've done? What are some principles or things that you try to do when you know you've breached trust, made a mistake, approached the situation in a way that was less than ideal? What are some things that you do?
So,
and this could be with a colleague or somebody in the community.
Yeah, I think for me, most of those situations have happened when I'm teaching. Mm. When I'm teaching cadets or I'm teaching officers and things like that, I might make a mistake or might miss the target or things like that. You know, we're all human and we're all going to make mistakes. I think the biggest thing with that is just being humble and be able to admit that you made a mistake.
Laugh actually, at yourself sometimes.
Yeah. 100% builds, 100% builds credibility, right? If I can mess up, but show that I messed up and talk about, hey, I messed up and this is all training. We're trying to move forward. It kind of builds some of that credibility. If I go into everything saying I'm perfect and I'm have that big, huge ego, and then I mess up, that completely just diminishes your credibility. So I try to preface everything with, when I teach, that, hey, I'm human. I'm going to show you some different ways that I do things. The way that I do things is not the only way. There's a lot of different ways to do this when I'm instructing, right? As far as like reloads or malfunction drills with guns, and that goes with everything, right? Communication is the same way. There's a lot of different ways to get to the determination of a communication or a conversation that you want to have. So I'll preface it with that. Say, hey, I'm human. We all make mistakes. These are the things that I do that I've found work best for me. There might be things that work differently for you. And I just try to go into it with that level of humility that can kind of show that I don't know everything. None of us know everything. We're all in this world just trying to do our best and continuing to learn.
Which is interesting, because that's definitely not the norm. I mean, it's, you watch a lot of people teach and people feel really compelled to prove something.
Yeah.
And I know there was a time in my career I did as well early on in my previous life as a strength coach. If I had the chance to teach, I'm thinking I have a responsibility. I'm representing an organization. I want to make sure that I do this well. But if you looked at it from the outside perspective, you could think, wow, that guy's using kind of a command and control right. style of teaching. And then you start to just something happens with life and experience. And after you've eaten it enough, or you just realize that true expertise is very, in a way, relaxed.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, it's all about providing value, not proving, but that can be tough. And I'd imagine you have to see it too in an emotionally in charge environment within law enforcement. I mean, do people, not everybody gets the opportunity. How do you get the opportunity to even teach cadets or those in that setting?
Yeah. So it's an application process, but yeah, I was recruited the first time I taught physical training and defensive tactics. So I was recruited by another officer who was the sergeant at the time. And he just appreciated the way that I taught. He'd seen me instruct in other areas and stuff before and thought that I just had a good way about me. And I think that's one of the biggest things is that I try to make the people that I teach comfortable.
You know,
if they're comfortable, then they're going to be able to learn. You know, nobody wants to go into a situation where they're just going to be talked at or demeaned and things like that. So while there's a lot of demeaning that goes on in the academy, as you can imagine, with cadets yelling and screaming and stuff, I still just was able to make them feel comfortable and realize that, hey, one day you're going to be an officer on the road with me, you know, and I want to get you to the point to where I want to work alongside you. So making that situation the most comfortable that they can and being able to kind of be a more of a colleague with them than an authoritarian.
Well, and I'm glad you bring that up. And I know that there's probably sensitive things here that you can't talk about. So if I need to move on, I need to move on. Mm-hmm. But we get a lot of questions due to the nature of our work about how to manage politics. And of course, we don't mean governmental politics. We mean micro politics. Everybody in their workplace. And I've yet to go into an organization that doesn't deal with some form of politics. It's a reality of just social life.
Absolutely.
And there's not just one question here. So I'm going to give you freedom to take it where you want. But what are examples of kind of interdepartmental or just politics that you've experienced in the workplace? And how do you manage them?
Yeah, so there is a lot of politics in law enforcement. And there's a lot of people who are trying to get to the next promotion.
Angling.
Like that. Yeah. And honestly, I used to get wrapped up in it a lot. I used to get wrapped up in it and get.
What does that mean? Do you mean you used to think you used to think proactively or?
No, I used to just get angry about it because there was people in positions that I didn't think they should be there. And there was a lot of pushback on things that I wanted to do that I wasn't able to do and make change. And then I got to the point to where I just started focusing on what I could control. You know, that I can control the way that I teach my officers. I can control the experience that my cadets are going to have with me. I can control those things. I can control the range days that I run for my officers now and get them the best training that I can provide. I can't control the huge bureaucracy. I can't control the stuff that we have, like our guns. I can't control any of that stuff, but I can control my attitude and the way that I approach the way that I teach and the stuff that I teach. So I just started focusing on what was important to my officers and what I could control. And then none of that other stuff really mattered.
And that's good insight, especially because just going back to, we had another law enforcement, a member of law enforcement on really early in the show. He actually was my neighbor and he was talking about one form of politics he dealt with surrounded body cams.
Yeah.
And he felt like his department, and I'm simplifying this for the sake of time, mm-hmm. could really use more officers, use more human capital.
Yeah.
But the head of the department was like, no, we need more body cams. And the issue was they didn't have enough storage space to even store a lot of the footage that these body cams were capturing. And so what was happening is a lot of public defenders had caught on to this and knew that in a certain amount of time, I don't know what it is, maybe you know, the footage of those body cams had to be erased. Cause even if it's stored on the cloud, there's so much right. gathered. And so he said, what was problematic to me is it almost felt like I couldn't do police work anymore. Cause you'd go get people off the streets and then they could basically just come back and deny that something had ever happened or that it happened in a certain way. They could say this and manipulate it. And it just was like, what are we doing here? Are we subject to just technology? We need more good cops. So I've got to imagine there's big frustrating things like that. And then there's also just got to be like in every profession, upstart douchebags that just want to make a name for themselves in the department. And so they'll make you look bad.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, And that was one of the things that I, like I said, I was really, really wrapped around is trying to figure out how I could make those changes, you know, up the ladder. And it's with a big bureaucracy. I work for a huge department.
How big?
7,000.
7,000?
6,000 to 7,000.
Include like officer, just officers or everybody?
Everybody.
Everybody.
Yeah. So, and we're spread out all over California and stuff. So it's really impossible to make those changes that you want to make as far as tactics or new training and stuff like that. But I can control my group of officers that work at my office, which is about 60. And so I can,
that's a good number.
Yeah, I can focus on them and I can focus on working. And I started doing that with everything, you know, whether it's my kids, I focus on what I can control, or in communication in any of my other jobs or other avenues that I teach, I focus on what I can control. And a lot of times that's kind of just given me the freedom to not worry about the stuff that I can't.
Yeah.
It's really refreshing.
What do you teach your kids? And by the way, if you don't mind, tell your audience how many kids you have. How many kids?
4.
What do you teach them about conflict resolution, some of the things that you have to, you know, that you've just innately encountered and had to deal with?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I teach them is just to treat everybody with respect, you know, treat people with respect, but also be able to ramp up situations if you need to, right? So I think the biggest thing is whether you have a conflict with a friend or conflict with any situation, just take a step back. Take a step back and kind of get that bird's eye view of the situation. Realize that everybody has different experiences, where the person that you're having a conflict might be coming from, and then kind of try to understand them, and then approach it the best way that you can.
Yeah, it's interesting because kids will start asking these questions early.
Yeah,
and it's funny because I'll take a path that you alluded to. If it's one of our clients or somebody that comes to our courses, right, we can get a little bit more forensic about identifying the source of the conflict, right? We can give them terminology. Mm-hmm. With Bronson, my 4-year-old, he's just recently, you know, those power dynamics start coming early. And he said the other day, "Daddy, so-and-so is not very nice to me." And I said, "Well, what happened?" And he goes into it and he's like, "What do I do?" I go, "Well, you don't have to play with them anymore. If somebody's not nice, you just walk away, go play with somebody else." Mm-hmm. And he said, "But sometimes he also hits me." I'm like, "Oh," and this is where, you know, my audience won't like that. I go, "Well, buddy, it's 2 options if he hits you. One, you go talk to the teacher." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Okay, what's the other one?" I go, "Just give him a little push back."
Yep.
And it's funny because some parents would say that's radical or whatever, but I remember specifically at his last daycare, he had this kid named Tor. And Bronson was coming home. This was like, Bronson was 3 at the time. He's coming home with black eye, other people coming home with black eye. I'm like, "Who is this kid?" I go in there and the teacher's like, "Yo, for what it's worth, I even told the other kids to whack this kid back." And so, you know, I'm telling a joke in this, but we see, and the research shows, these political games, these power dynamics, these issues with conflict start early in the sense that kids don't really know how to reconcile them. And then those kids become adults that don't know how to reconcile them because they don't get teaching or strategy on it.
Right.
And so it's interesting. I always want to ask, like, "Well, yeah, what would you teach your kids about conflict?" Because you can say, "Well, take the high road."
Yeah.
And any number of these books beside you right now as we're sitting here will tell you that. And I just remember myself, I was just like, "Well, what's the high road all the time?"
Yeah.
You know, because there is a point in time where you can say, "Hey, I'm going to walk away. I'm going to be the bigger person." But there's also a fine line between, you need to know when to not be a doormat.
Absolutely. Yeah. I taught my kids that from a very young age, to know who you are. Know who
That's
you
tough.
Are. Yeah. Know who you are and realize that if somebody tries to alter that, that's not okay. Like my daughter recently got married last
year. In like a negative, abusive way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My daughter got married last year and then 7 months later went through a divorce, you know, and the whole 7 months that she was dealing with that, she was changing who she was. And we had those conversations a lot.
In terms of her values?
No, not in terms of her values, but she just wasn't her happy self. She wasn't doing a lot of things that she liked to do as far as like doing the music that she loved to play or being artistic and things like that. So she was changing because she was being pushed down. She was facing a lot of adversity and wasn't able to stay who she was. I said, and I told her that. I said, "McKenna, if you can't be the person that you are supposed to be, then something's wrong. You're in a bad situation." So she realized that and was able to get out of that relationship. But that's the biggest thing I think that we need to realize is, and even in police work, know who you are, know your values, know what, why you became a police officer in the first place. If you became a police officer to go out and write tickets to soccer moms, then maybe you need to find a new job. But if you became a police officer to make the world a better place, take a step back and realize, is that actually what you're doing? Is that what you're doing? And is that what you're still focused on? Or are you falling victim to the bureaucracy of what you're being told that is why you became a police officer?
No, that's an excellent point. I was going to ask, you know, what's the balance to that? Because I know the context that you gave those examples in, but there's people out there and there is an argument to be made. I would say people need to be willing to change who they are. Like, you get married, my wife's not the same person. Oh, she's taken on some of me, I've taken on some of her. Yeah. So can you differentiate between what you mean by that? Because we all should evolve who we are.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I've been married 22 years and crazy in law enforcement. Like, she knew me before I was a cop. So I say that's why she still loves me. But yeah, we've been married 22 years and we've completely changed. Like, I've changed some things in my life and she's changed some things in hers. But if you're not changing for the positive, like if you're not progressing, you're just regressing. And I talk about that a lot too with my students and stuff like that. If you're not progressing and not actually moving forward with your life and you're regressing, or you've regressed back to things that you don't like about yourself, or you're doing things that don't bring any meaning to your life, then that's what I'm talking about. You know who you are. You need to continue to progress and continue to progress for the positive. And if you're not progressing, then you're just regressing.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing because sometimes, and you feel free to disagree with this, sometimes changing for the positive doesn't feel like it in the moment.
Right.
And what I mean is, so I'm working with a client right now and he's trying to overcome some internal politics at work. And I said, hey, imagine there is almost this anti-hero version of yourself. Not necessarily dark, because an anti-hero is more of a gray character, right? Depending on, and we're not talking about comedic anti-heroes like Deadpool. I just mean, you know, somebody that knows that life isn't black and white.
Right.
And you have to sometimes break some rules and you're going to have to deal with some moral ambiguity. That's reality. Because even if we try to do the most ethical thing in the world, there's going to be secondary consequences of that. So I said, what would the anti-hero version of you do? And just for fun, let's think of the antithesis. And he said, well, I'm a peacekeeper by trade. Like, I'm just somebody that's very analytical, but I'm going to try to keep the peace. So I guess the anti-hero version of myself would maybe stir up some shit a little bit, maybe be a little bit more assertive. And I said, well, could you imagine how that might be useful in this scenario? And I want to respect his privacy, so I'm not going to get into that, right? But he was like, yeah, I just don't think it would feel very good. And I said, well, I acknowledge that, and I appreciate you being honest about that, but could it lead to a net positive result? And he said, yeah, I think it could. And there's no agenda in me bringing that up. It's more of just teeing it up for you to riff off of. Mm-hmm. And do you think there's ever a time where that's valid, that maybe we need to lean into the darker side of ourself or some traits that we don't see as traditionally like conventional or clean, and we can find value there? Or do you think no?
No, I think that's definitely a viable option. You know, the ends justify the means sometimes, right? So if I want to get to a point to where I'm progressing or I'm making progress, I might need to go a different route than I normally would. Go around what's traditionally acceptable. And I think that's definitely an option. I've seen that a few times in my life with different things to come to different conclusions. And I think that in any given circumstance, there's not one, like I said before, there's not one right way to come to a conclusion. You have to kind of, it's trial and error.
Yeah. So with that, are you cool with me firing some hot seat questions that are on theme with this?
Absolutely.
And then we're going to end this. You'll get control on how we end this. So sticking with that, sometimes leaning into different aspects of yourself, whether it's the anti-hero, an alternate persona, anything like that, I'm going to ask you some questions. What are some traits or qualities that you, and the wording's tough here, that you try to avoid, or maybe you've previously rejected in yourself, and how have embracing or understanding those qualities or selectively leveraging them actually helped you at times?
Like I said, I think I'm...
Give me something that you feel like is usually like, man, that wouldn't be looked at as by most people. Like for me, just because I don't want to be vague.
Right.
I can be hot-tempered.
Yeah.
And I know that there's many times I got to manage that. There's other times where it's tremendously focusing to me.
Yeah.
You could argue that I've created my best content, whether written or otherwise, when I'm really frustrated about something.
Yeah.
And so that anger is useful to me. that if I know how to leverage, does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. And I think I'm kind of the same way. I'm so even keel and so like relaxed most of the time and approach situations with like that bird's eye view that I think dialing in and actually, becoming more aggressive, and attacking things is out of character sometimes for me, but I think I've had some of the best success when I do that.
Yeah.
So it's a great just example. Being more aggressive, you know, being more aggressive.
With decision making and two and stuff, right? Yeah.
And actually, and just being able to make decisions on the fly. You know, sometimes I can't take that bird's eye view and sometimes I do have to rush in. And I think I've made the best decisions when I've done that, when I've done things dynamically rather than just kind of take a step back and wait for things to evolve.
Yeah. That's something I appreciate you bringing that up. That's something we've talked, Liz and I have talked about a good bit is she can tend to be somebody that wants to sit back and analyze a lot. And I'm like, hey, sometimes you just got to make faster decisions. You got to go with your gut. And then periodically I've got to do the opposite of that. So I think that's an important thing for people to just consider.
Yeah.
There are certain traits and behaviors that are kind of beaten out of us through society. Oh, this isn't socially acceptable, or this doesn't appear like the right thing to do, to the point where I don't even know if we can tell dirty jokes anymore half the time.
Right.
But it is sometimes, and I talked about this in conscious coaching, sometimes those dark-sided traits and behaviors can have a benefit. All right, let me give you another one. Okay. Let's see here. I don't want to make it too easy. If you, that's a tough one too. Let me see. All right. So what do you feel like, what is a lie or a misconception you've told yourself in the past, or maybe you're telling yourself now about your ability, your self-worth, a situation. And what I mean to ground this is any movie, any book starts with a lie that the character believes. Good Will Hunting, he doesn't believe that he's worthy of love because he's got a traumatic past. Thor thinks that all of his strength comes from Mjolnir and his powers, right? So he gets sent to Earth. Everything is old as time. You can find him in the Bible. You can find him on your bookshelf. You can find him in the movie. The character starts as incomplete. They have a self-limiting belief, which is usually reinforced by something they went through in life. Mm-hmm. And they've got to overcome that. What is something you've had to overcome, like a self-limiting belief or lie at certain points in your life?
I think, and my wife will tell you this, I think like I always try to just convince her that I'm just a normal guy. You know, I'm just a normal guy going through the motions day to day. And she always tries to tell me how exceptional I am. How I have four jobs and I'm always out there teaching. I'm always out there trying to make the world a better place and do all these things. And I think I get wrapped up in that so much because I see so many people in the world that are doing so many amazing things. And I think I'm just a normal guy. I have a small conglomerate of people that actually follow me. I have a small group of people that I have a little bit of influence over, but I don't see myself as being, anything grandiose or anything, but you know, there are people that do. My wife and my kids are the ones that do. And when you take a look at that, that's what really matters. You know, the people that are closest to you are the ones that are who really know you, you know. But I think that's the biggest thing for me is I just feel like I'm a normal guy just going through the motions.
But how does that negatively impact you? Because that's yeah. one thing that's hallmarked by a lie that a character believes or their ghost or whatever mm-hmm. is. It keeps them from being this realized self.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that it does negatively impact me.
Then it can't be a lie. It can't be a self-limiting belief.
That's true.
We got to go deeper.
I don't know if I have one.
Yeah. Then. Well, we're going to sit here and tell you that. Right. Like I think it's important. It can change. Mm-hmm. There's times where, I mean, I don't do what I do for fun. I do it to make a difference, but there's certainly sometimes that lie could creep up for me. Is it really?
Right.
Am I making a difference?
Right.
And it's easy to say, well, yeah, you made a difference in my life, but I know this sounds cynical and I'm a darker shade of gray than most. But I've also we grew up and a lot of relatives died early. Mm-hmm. And you kind of see how, all right, somebody can die. People miss them for a year or two, unless it's, you know, your parents or your wife. And it just kind of, the world keeps spinning. So sometimes I can get caught up being like, hey, is what I'm doing, this book, that podcast, the 300 I've done, does it really matter? Or if long after I'm worm food or whatever, are people just going to forget? And it's tricky because that lie or those like that can start to keep you from doing certain things or applying effort. And so there's a lot of people out there that feel like, well, I'm not good at, and some people think they're too good mm-hmm. at things. Like there's a lie. Some characters believe that I know are there that I'm already good enough at communication. I'm already good at this. So I just encourage anybody listening to this, think about something that's self-limiting, whether, oh, if I start this, it won't matter, or I'm only good if I stay in this field. Otherwise I've wasted my life if I change careers. or people only like me because of blank. Think of whatever that lie is. I know another person that came on one time talked about how they bought into this for a long time, that if they put themselves out there, that they'd be self-promoting and it would remove the purity of what they did. And I remember laughing at that because that was something a lot of coaches think about. Oh, if you put yourself out there, you're a guru. You're not in it for the right reason. I'm like, wow, that sounds like a really insecure thing to say. Because you can see you see a musician, they need to promote their album.
Yeah.
You see Nick Saban on Aflac commercials. People are, I think it's the opposite. It's pretty vain to think you could be good at what you do and that people should just know it without putting yourself out there. But that's kind of what I mean by that. So I'm going to give you one more chance to think of the self-limiting belief.
Yeah, I think, well, like you said, I think that is the biggest thing for me. Am I really making a difference?
Yeah.
You know, and in any aspect, you know, I teach firearms training. I'm a law enforcement officer. I help teach for Art of Coaching, but am I really making a difference? And a lot of times I think that, we never really see it, you know, I think I need to be more okay with that I might not see the changes that I'm making, but I just continue to put myself out there. But I think that's the biggest thing is like, I'm working so hard. I work 3 or 4 jobs and I'm trying to support my family and do all those things. Does it really matter?
Yeah.
You know, does it really matter in the end, or did I miss out on things that I should have focused on more just because I'm trying to put myself out there in different aspects?
Yeah. Well, you hit on a rich vein there of you're not always going to see that difference.
Yeah.
There's people that I thought that I'd never reached. And then something as simple as a social media post they put out where they used a quote that I'd utilized. Now, whether they attributed it to me or not, I'm like, oh, okay, something stuck there subconsciously. Mm-hmm. Or I think that's a big lie in general. If you think you're only a good leader or you're only good if you make an immediate impact,
yeah,
that would be a huge slap in the face to anybody that fought for civil rights, women's rights, any rights whatsoever. A lot of those times we're still fighting for certain things.
Yeah.
And, or think about the founding fathers, right? Think about anything. A lot of times, I mean, if we do die and become ghosts and everything, we're sitting there being like, it's 1,000 years and these people still haven't figured it out yet. Was it all in vain? But you just got to figure out, like, I think a better question to ask yourself is, am I contributing?
Right.
Because that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Right. You know that you're not making a difference if you sit on the sidelines. And so letting that cynicism of, well, I don't know if it would matter. Well, it's definitely not going to matter if you don't do anything.
Right.
You know, I want to give you the final word. We've talked about impression management, perception, personal growth, biases, overcoming your demons. Anything else you want to get off your chest?
No, I appreciate you having me on. I think that, like I talked about before, if you're out there practicing to become a professional in any aspect of your life and you're not practicing communication, you're not practicing how to communicate and how to interact with either your employees or your bosses or your family or those around you, then you're missing a big aspect of what's going to make you a well-rounded person.
They're going to think I paid you to say that.
No, they might, but... Yeah.
Did I?
No.
All right, Liz didn't transfer anything?
No.
And we don't have your Venmo?
Nope.
Well, I want to tell you how much I appreciate it. You know, this isn't like other podcasts. We don't go through weeks of preparation. You come on and you're going to be asked what you're going to be asked. And you've got to roll the punches and improvise. And some people do that and they don't necessarily mean to, but sometimes can give superficial answers, kind of play it safe. I especially appreciate that you didn't. Yeah. Because you are in a job where there's a lot of public scrutiny. It's very visible. People already have preconceived notions of it. And you didn't hold back. So I want to thank you for taking the time and coming on down and doing this.
No problem. Try to be real.
All right, folks, listen, if anything in here helped you whatsoever, please share it with at least 5 people. We do this because we love this, but it's also our livelihood. The only way that we can continue to do these things is with the support of people like you. So you can go to artofcoaching.com/begin and hop on our newsletter, learn more about our courses, our live events, our one-to-one virtual mentoring. We have something for everybody. You don't have to travel. If you want to travel and get around other people, there's options for that too. But we just appreciate you spreading the word. So for myself, Tyson, and the rest of the Art of Coaching team, we're thankful for you and we'll talk to you next time.